Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my dear brothers and sisters. As you may have guessed from that reading, we're going to start our study in this first session this morning by embarking on matters that will take us into the Garden of Eden. In fact, we're going to begin a timeline of the consideration of Gabriel's work, and it's going to begin all the way back here with, in fact, the time and the circumstances of Adam himself. But actually, our story begins even before Genesis chapter 3, because this story is so ancient and its message so vital that it begins at the very beginning of time itself. If you come to Genesis chapter 1, do you remember what the record says? And what we're going to look at now, everything between now and when we finally get to Genesis chapter 3, is sort of like the critical background to the studies as a whole. Everything we say will make sense in the studies as we go through them one by one. And it begins right here in Genesis chapter 1. Reading from the first verse, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, Let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day." Now, do you notice the order? First, darkness, verse 2. Then light, verse 3. Now, these were different as day and night and black and white. And God divided them, says the record. See, the margin says he divided between the light and between the darkness. They each symbolized something of supreme importance right from the beginning of the Genesis record. You see, in the natural circumstance of life, morning begins the day, and the evening crowns its close. Even the laws of Israel that govern daily life, the daily tasks of temple worship, were all based upon what might be done from the morning until the evening, because the labours of mankind are performed during the daylight hours. So says Psalm 104, verses 19 to 23. But in the spiritual cycle, in the sacred cycle of God's day, it would run from evening to morning, says verse 5. And that would teach that life comes out of death as morning comes out of evening. And the very journey of the sun, in its journeyings each day, became a parable, you see, because as the sun descends and dies in its sunset, the evening sky is turned into the red of blood, and then from red to black to indicate that life has been extinguished and the night of death has come. And as the sun arises and lives in its sunrise, the morning sky is eventually turned into blue to indicate that death has been abolished and the day of life has come. First, the darkness of evening and the death of Christ, and then the brightness of morning and the resurrection of Christ. So you see, what we've got here is a perpetual confirmation that darkness precedes light in relation to the present constitution of things upon the earth. And do you notice, brothers and sisters, there's no mistake in the record, because the margin says, "And the evening was, and the morning was, the first day. And from henceforth, each day will be measured in this way, evening first, and then the morning." Do you know that in our hymn book we have evening hymns and morning hymns? But even in our hymn book, the evening hymns come first. Did you notice that? And then the morning hymns. It is an acknowledgement of the principle of Genesis chapter 1 and verse 5. Do you know what we've really got here, brothers and sisters? In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 5, we've got the very first prophecy of the death and resurrection of Christ. Now, what makes that astonishing, absolutely astonishing, is that this occurs before the creation of a man, before the creation of a woman, before their placement in the garden, before their conversation with the serpent, before their temptation, before the fall. This prophecy is on the first day of creation. God already knew that man would fail, and he had already provided for the complete work of redemption that would be accomplished in his Son. God already had an answer. It's an overwhelming thought, brothers and sisters, that from the beginning, from the very first day of creation, when God alone was God alone had the answer, and the death and resurrection of Christ was hidden at the very start of time. Now, I think that's really the spirit of these passages, you see, which we shan't turn up, but let's just see what it says. Romans 16, verses 25 and 26. The preaching of Jesus Christ, says the apostle, which was kept secret since the world began, but now is made manifest and, according to the everlasting God, made known to the nations. This secret was since the world began. It's hiding there, right, on the very first day of creation. That God would work in his Son to save the race. Or again, in the 2nd of Timothy, chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, God who hath saved according to his own purpose, which was given us before the world began, but is now made manifest by the appearing of our Saviour, which hath abolished death and brought life and immortality to light. And one final passage in Titus chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, that says, in hope of eternal life, which God that cannot lie promised before the world began, but hath in due time manifested his word through preaching. So you see, brothers and sisters, so important was this work, so deeply related to the Father's ultimate purpose, that from the beginning, men and women would learn that even time itself would be measured by the death and the resurrection of Christ. That's how time itself would be measured. From evening to morning, from darkness to light, from death to life. Now that cycle of the sacred day was embedded in the law of Moses, and it was found in a remarkable offering that the law prescribed in Numbers chapter 28. And you'll be familiar with this offering, but it's worthy of our attention because it becomes a critical part of our story and our studies. That idea of God's measurement of time itself based on the work of his own Son is captured in this offering in Numbers 28 and reading from verse 1. The record says, and Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, command the children of Israel and say unto them, my offering and my bread for my sacrifices made by fire for a sweet savour unto me shall ye observe to offer unto me in their due season. And thou shalt say unto them, this is the offering made by fire which ye shall offer. So of all the offerings which were counted as belonging to God, this is where it all began. This one mentioned here. Two lambs of the first year without spot, day by day, for a continual burnt offering. The one lamb thou shalt offer in the morning, and the other lamb thou shalt offer at even. And so this continual lamb, in the Hebrew the word is tamid, T-A-M-I-D, and it was called a continual lamb because when the ashes of the one lamb were being removed, the offering of the next lamb was already being placed upon the altar at the same time, so that there was always a lamb burning upon the altar. And those two lambs, the two daily lambs, became the basis for the entire sacrificial code that followed. Everything was based upon these two lambs. Every day began and ended with these two lambs. every single day, no matter how significant or important it was. Now, you see what they were offered? It says in verse 3, one of them was offered in the morning, verse 4, but the other one, it says, the other lamb thou shalt offer at even. But the margin says, between the evenings. Now, it's interesting, that phrase, because the Jews, as they are wont, embarked upon a complicated and difficult discussion that ended up in two groups of schools of thought being diametrically opposed as to what between the evenings meant. So the Jews have always had two different opinions on the matter, which is not an uncommon thing when Jews debate the law. But actually, I think it's quite clear what the real meaning of between the evenings was, because it turned out to be the actual practice of the Jewish people, and it fits the purpose of God. You see, there were no watches in those days. So how did you measure where the sun was? How did you work out when it was between the evenings or at the start of the day? Well, the answer is everything was measured by where the sun stood. If the sun was just beginning, then everything from the sun beginning up till the zenith at noon is the morning, or at least the morning part of the daytime. But from the moment the sun reaches its zenith, of course, it begins to fall, it begins to die, and it will be finally extinguished at sunset. And so between the evenings was finally understood as that moment of time, the halfway point between when decline begins at the zenith and when the sun is finally extinguished at 6 o'clock at night. And between the evenings was 3 o'clock in the middle. And that's when the evening lamb was offered in the end by the Jewish people. I think they got it right, by the way. Absolutely right. It was offered at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the evening lamb. And corresponding to that, the morning lamb was offered at 9 o'clock in the morning, which was the halfway point between 6 a.m. and the sun reaching its zenith. That's exactly when these two lambs were offered. Or do you see what it says in verse 5? It says that when this lamb was offered, verse 5, a tenth part of an ephah of flour for a meal offering should accompany it. And verse 7 says, and it must also have a drink offering. So this lamb, this special lamb, an evening and morning lamb, when it was offered, must always be accompanied with bread and wine. It was a sacrifice made by fire, and as such, it was a burnt offering. And the actual smell of the offering may not have been attractive, but when the record says here that it is a sweet savour unto God, it is because, of course, the sweetness of its savour lay in the fragrance of the principles it represented. And because that lamb came first and last, and last and first, on every day it embraced all the offerings of the sacrificial code. In fact, if you wanted a summary of the entire Mosaic sacrificial system, the daily lamb encompassed it all from start to finish, from evening lamb to morning lamb. Even the Day of Atonement was not exempt from the law of the lambs. When that day began at 6 o'clock at night, there was already an evening lamb smouldering on the altar. And when the priest the next morning rose to make his offerings, he had to offer a special bullock and a special ram and a special lamb and a special goat, but he could not declare the Day of Atonement as finished until the last sacrifice for that day was offered. And the last sacrifice was the evening lamb at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Only then could the high priest declare that the Day of Atonement had been fulfilled. So by the time we come to the time of Christ, those offerings, the offerings of the two lambs, had developed into what was known as the regular daily service of the lamb. That was a whole section of the Talmud devoted to describing how that Tamid offering should be organized. And it essentially followed this rule. So the first thing is that the lamb itself was slain. The blood was sprinkled, and the lamb was placed in order on the altar of burnt offering as an ascending sacrifice. And as soon as the lamb had been offered, the officiating priest then took incense and took it into the holy place that he might burn incense on the altar there and offered prayers on behalf of the nation. And at the same time, a minkah was added plus a drink offering, was added to the Tamid lamb that it might be presented as a memorial on the same altar as the lamb was first burning. And finally, when the priest had come out from offering the incense of prayer, he returned, and having blessed the people, they then offered a song of praise, which was sung as an ascending hymn. In fact, you see the key word here? It was an ascending sacrifice. The incense represented ascending prayers. The meal offering was an ascending memorial, and the song of praise was an ascending hymn. So there was a whole code that was built around this daily lamb, you see. And every one of those items was associated with the law of Tamid and was the basis of the temple service in the days of our Lord Jesus Christ. So now here's the question, brothers and sisters. So when that service of the lamb was instituted in the law of Moses, on the very first occasion that such a lamb was offered, which one do you think was offered first? An evening lamb or a morning lamb? What thinkest thou? And the answer is, I think the law of Moses probably tells us, because if you come to Leviticus chapter 6, we're told this, that the law was express in terms of how it described the institution of the law of burnt offering. Leviticus chapter 6 says this in verse 8. Yahweh said unto Moses, saying, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law of the burnt offering. It is the burnt offering because of the burning upon the altar all night unto the morning, and the fire of the altar shall be burning upon it. It began, brothers and sisters, the entire code of burnt offering began with an evening lamb. The very first time that the altar was fired up, as it were, and began its burning, that burning would never go out once it had begun. But it began with an evening lamb burning all night until the morning. And the record's quite clear, because you see, what would happen is, the next day, verse 10, the priest would change his clothes, he'd take away the ashes from the evening lamb, he'd take those to another place, he'd change his garments, and then verse 12 says, the fire upon the altar shall be burning in it, it shall not be put out, and the priest shall burn wood on it every morning and lay the burnt offering in order upon it, and he shall burn thereon the fat of the peace offerings, and the fire shall ever be burning upon the altar. So each morning the altar was to be replenished with new wood, and the clear force of that passage is that every morning there was a renewal of what had already been burning on the altar the previous night. So the law of burnt offering began with a burning all night until the morning, and that burning came from the offering of the evening lamb. The first Tamid or continual lamb under the Mosaic ordinance was an evening lamb, and from thenceforth the cycle of the lambs would always be the same. Evening, morning, evening, morning, evening, morning. And you know what's interesting about that idea, brothers and sisters? It's this, that every evening a priest offered a lamb and then went to sleep. And every morning, a priest arose and then offered a morning lamb. Oh yes, the death and the resurrection of Christ would be hidden in the work of these priests and the lambs they would offer. And there's another reason, you see, why we believe that that first lamb in the book of the law was an evening lamb. And that reason is because, you see, this particular sacrifice, this particular lamb, predated the law. This lamb went all the way back to the beginning of time to a lamb that was offered at the foundation of the world. Consider the clues from Leviticus 6. There is an officiating priest. There is a sacrificial lamb. There is clothing to cover nakedness. There is an appointed place of worship. There is an altar of sacrifice. There is flaming fire. And there is wood, which the Jewish people said could only come from the fig tree. Oh, now, where have we heard all those ideas before in the Bible record? And the answer, of course, is that this story didn't begin in Leviticus chapter 6. It began in Genesis chapter 3. So let's come back to the Genesis record, and let's just consider what's going on here in the passages we had it read together by our brother from Genesis chapter 3. Now, it's interesting, this section, because you realise that the whole narrative of this part of Genesis is actually associated with the use of a particular term. And that term is Yahweh Elohim. Do you notice it's mentioned in chapter 2, verse 4, for the first time? These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day when Yahweh Elohim made the earth and the heavens. And from that verse onwards, in Genesis 2, right through to chapter 3 and verse 23, when it says, "And Yahweh Elohim sent him forth from the Garden of Eden," that will be the term used to describe the appearance and the manifestation of God, these two particular chapters. And if we read chapter 3, verse 8, which is where we started our reading, notice what it says. They heard the voice of Yahweh Elohim walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Yahweh Elohim. So clearly it indicates that it was a specific personage. If they could hide themselves from him, it must be a real being who had conversed with them. Incidentally, isn't it a strange expression, don't you think? They heard a voice walking. Did you notice that? They heard a voice walking in the garden, the voice of Yahweh Elohim. We'll come back to that, brothers and sisters, later on in our studies, God willing. Now, let me draw your attention to something that Brother Thomas says in Elpis Israel about who the Yahweh Elohim is of Genesis chapters 2 and 3. So this is a section of little quotations taken from pages 83, 185 and 186 from Elpis Israel. This is what Brother Thomas says. Just notice the key word. He says, "He, that is the serpent, had heard of the tree of knowledge and the tree of lives, which were both in the midst of the garden. He had heard the Lord Elohim," he calls him, "and the other Elohim conversing." See that little title? The Lord Elohim, says Brother Thomas. And then later on he says, "The animals were still without a king, therefore said the chief of the Elohim." And then lastly he will say, "The Lord of the Elohim said to his celestial companions, the Ark Elohim said that the man had become." And you see, I think that Brother Thomas is not just suggesting that there was an angel in the garden. I think he was suggesting that there was an archangel in the garden, the chief of the Elohim, an Ark Elohim. Which makes sense when you think about it. Because think of the dramatic occurrences that take place in these chapters. The formation of man, his placing in the garden, the giving of the commandment, the formation of the woman, the discussion with the serpent, the transgression and the fall, the judgments that followed, the institution of sacrifice, and the expulsion from the garden. These were all extremely important matters that should have been presided over by a chief angel. The momentous events of these chapters are described in the New Testament as the foundation of the world, and they were of such importance to the Bible record that to have an archangel superintending them was both necessary and wise. The question is, which archangel? Well, let me ask you some questions from the Genesis record. This is only a handful of a much larger list. So in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, which archangel do you think might be best associated with the formation of the first Adam? or again in Genesis chapter 2, verse 21, which archangel is best associated with the deep sleep of Adam and his awakening? Or in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, which archangel is best associated with the promise of the seed of the woman who will be bruised in order for victory to come? Or again, in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 21, which archangel might best be associated with the slaying of a lamb and the provision of an atoning sacrifice? That's the verse we're about to come to very shortly, God willing. Or in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 24, which angel do you think it might be that's best associated with the barring of the way to the tree of life? So I suggest, brothers and sisters, that the angel in the garden was Gabriel, one of God's archangels, and that he's the right person for this matter, you see. Now let's have a look at it. We're going to come to Genesis chapter 3 in verse 21. We've only got time to look at one verse because there's quite a lot to think about in Genesis chapter 3 in verse 21. So this is what the record says in this verse. And unto Adam also and to his wife did Yahweh Elohim make coats of skins and clothe them. Now, what's all this about then? Well, it's about the fact that this whole dilemma in the garden stood related to how men and women might draw near to God to worship him, to declare the rightness of his principles and to honour him. And what we're going to learn from our studies is that the atonement is God's own medium to restore men and women into harmony with himself, to permit the real objective he has, and that is that they might manifest him more perfectly. And you see, right from the beginning, God knew what was needed. God would require the declaration of his righteousness and his holiness first, as the prerequisite, as the basis for the extension of his love and mercy. They would come, but his righteousness must be acknowledged first. And ultimately, what was needed, of course, was a representative of the human nature that Adam and Eve would now possess. Not an animal, one bearing the nature, who could die to declare the righteousness of God. But death wasn't of itself sufficient either, was it? One had to be raised, otherwise there'd be no victory. A death would satisfy the divine requirement in one respect, but it certainly would be a failure without the reversal of death. There needed to be life brought forth, but this needed a sinless offering without blemish, the offering of one who was in the same nature as man, but never yielding to its impulses. But the problem was, in Genesis chapter 3, is that there was never going to be such a man, because from the moment Adam and Eve sinned and they were judged, the consequences rendered it impossible for a deliverer to ever come from within the human race. And part of the challenge of Genesis chapter 3 is that of ourselves, brothers and sisters, it is not possible for us to be reconciled with God. The rupture was so great that in the end, God had to give his own son to bridge the gap. God would have to intervene. God alone could provide because we could not do it ourselves. And he needed to provide a redeemer with the necessary qualities. There was only one way possible that God could do that. He would have to bring forth his own son, one who alone would have the capacity to triumph, a son who would offer himself as the sacrifice needed for the rescue of the race and for the incorporation of that race into the purpose of God. The drama of Genesis 3, verse 21, is all about the resolution of the problem of sin, you see. It's sin that separated Adam and Eve from God. So the emphasis on this story and on this sacrifice that will be made in verse 21 is not about salvation from death. It's about salvation from sin. If we want to have salvation from death, we must first deal with the matter of sin. And isn't that how the Lord will be introduced in the New Testament record? Matthew chapter 1 verse 21 says, "And thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from," not from death, "from their sins." Now we're not told here in Genesis chapter 3 verse 21, are we, what animal was offered. But it was undoubtedly a lamb. As the story of Gabriel is going to reveal, and as Scripture confirms. Because isn't that really the force of what Peter says in the 1st of Peter chapter 1, verses 18 to 20, when he talks about the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world? And the ordaining of Christ as that spotless lamb, says Peter, was seen in the garden, right at the start of things. What Christ would one day do, what Christ would one day accomplish, was going to be foreshadowed in the Lamb of Genesis chapter 3 and verse 21. And likewise, Revelation chapter 13 is going to say, is it not? Those whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. Now, in Eureka, Brother Thomas argues cogently that that phrase, the foundation of the world, probably has more connection with the phrase, the book of life, than it does with the lamb slain. But I think both of these things are true. The lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. In the lamb, that's reported to us here in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 21. Now, let me tell you something interesting about that verse. Shall we read it again? I'll just read it to you the way it should be read from the Hebrew. And unto Adam also, and to his wife, did Yahweh Elohim make coats of a skin and clothe them. And in the Hebrew, the word skin is not only in the singular, it's also in the masculine. There was only one skin, brothers and sisters, because there was only one lamb. And that lamb was a male lamb. And yet that one lamb would be able to provide a covering for all, because you see, Adam and Eve were typical of the race that sprang from them. The coat of skin, this covering by sacrifice, wasn't just their need on this day. The lamb slain would need to provide a covering that was effective for all humanity. Right from Eden, the lamb was needed to take away the sins of the world. And in the providence of God, marvellous, brothers and sisters, in the providence of God, only one lamb skin would be necessary for that covering to be absolute. And when all was ready, what Adam and Eve had to do, even though the record doesn't say so, but it's obvious when you think about it, you know, the first thing they had to do, they had to take off their fig leaves. And they had to stand naked in confession before God that their own clumsy attempts at covering sin were not adequate. And they had to be prepared to receive the clothing that God approved of, that satisfied his principles. A covering that would deal with conscience and clothe their shame. It's an interesting story, the story of the fig leaves. We shan't spend time on it, but may I just make one observation? You know, brothers and sisters, we talk about the fact that since the garden that we have a bias towards sin. And so we do. But I think what the story of the fig leaves tells us is that we don't just have a bias towards sin. We have a bias towards the concealment of sin. We have a bias towards the denial of sin. And part of what Adam and Eve need to be confronted with here by taking off the fig leaves was that they needed to come to that state of absolute recognition of where they stood and the need they had, and in confessing that to the Father, might bow before the offering, which the covering that he alone could provide. So how do you think Genesis chapter 3 verse 21 occurred when it says that Yahweh Elohim made coats of skins and clothed them? What do you think actually happened? Well, Brother Thomas suggests that Adam offered the lamb in his capacity as the priest of the family. That the angel brought the lamb to Adam and said, you must offer the lamb. You're the priest of the family. And the very fact that the slain lamb had its skin removed marks it out as what type of offering? A burnt offering. Leviticus chapter 1 verse 6, the skin must be removed before the burnt offering can be offered. And do you know what Leviticus 7 verse 8 tells us as to who received the skin of the lamb? Why, the officiating priest who offered it, which on this day was Adam. Now, can you imagine, brothers and sisters, this moment when the angel brought this lamb to Adam and commanded him to slay it? Because this lamb was the first sacrificial death, and it must have absolutely shocked Adam and Eve as they saw the blood draining from the body, as they saw the little body going into convulsions, as they saw the glassless eyes and the final death rattle as life was extinguished from this little animal. The horror that Adam and Eve had in seeing the lamb slain and its blood shed, sacrificed to provide a covering for their sin. They must have been absolutely shocked at the drama of this moment. Now you see, the angel at a touch could cure the skin, but Adam would have to bring the blood before Yahweh, which the angel represented, and then offer the lamb itself upon the altar. Can we even begin to comprehend what gratitude Adam and Eve must have felt that day? What humility, what thankfulness, what realization of sin, what understanding of its consequence in their lives? In fact, I suggest, brothers and sisters, in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 21, that this lamb offered this day was probably the foundation for the holiest day in Israel's calendar, the Day of Atonement. What do the Jews call the Day of Atonement? Yom Kippurim, the Day of coverings. It will begin and end with an evening lamb. And I think Adam and Eve understood many of these things. They must have, by the way, because acceptable sacrifice is based upon the outworking of faith, and faith is predicated on knowledge. And we know they must have had that knowledge, because you see what it says in Genesis chapter 4, verses 3 and 4? This is what they taught their own children. In process of time, it came to pass, Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering, Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, and Yahweh had respect unto Abel and his offering. So this family, the family of Adam and Eve, knew about the fact there was an appropriate time for sacrifice, there was a place for sacrifice, there was an altar for sacrifice, there was a firstling lamb needed, the fat was important, and a minkah must be added. Where do they learn all those things from, other than from Adam and Eve, their parents? You see, Adam and Eve probably understood far more than we think they understood from this very brief moment of Genesis chapter 3 verse 21. And I think what we're being told here, you see, is that none of this happened by accident. The slaying of the lamb, the shedding of the blood, the covering of the skin, the service of the priest, the sacrifice on the altar, all of this was guided by the angel at the appointed place of worship in Eden to teach one thing, that the way, the only way to the tree of life was through the blood of the slain lamb. Now, what we've really got here in Genesis chapter 3 is an amazing, detailed, intricate foreshadowing of the sacrificial work of Christ. And given that this is the first great prophecy of Messiah's atoning work, which angel do you think should be there to superintend the events of this moment? Which angel had responsibility for Messiah's work? And the answer, of course, is Gabriel. And in this story, we will find that God, you see, left nothing to chance. Every stage, every step, every detail was planned in his purpose, beginning with this very episode, because this was the story of God's own son, the precious lamb of God. And long before the advent of Messiah himself, God sent an angel, this angel, who would personally prepare the way for the Lord whom he would serve. from the beginning of time, I think Gabriel was committed to this endeavour. Who better to instruct Adam and Eve as to how and why this lamb pointed forward to the promised Redeemer than Gabriel? And I think there's one final reason why we believe that Gabriel is in this story. And the answer is because he's left his signature here. So ask yourself this question, brothers and sisters. When does this entire transaction take place? This meeting in the garden with Yahweh Elohim and the offering of this lamb. When is this prophecy of the bruised heel? When is this promise of the slain lamb? Well, Genesis will be very specific in telling us when all this will occur on this day. Do you see what verse 8 says? It says they heard the voice of Yahweh Elohim walking in the garden in the cool of the day. It's almost like an apparently insignificant detail, and yet that little phrase, in the cool of the day, actually pinpoints the exact time of the day that this episode occurred. The precise moment this lamb was going to be offered in verse 21. Now, in the Hebrew, that phrase is leruach hayom, and the margin's quite correct when it says that we probably ought to translate it the wind of the day. Now, what wind was that? Well, this is what Kyle and Delitzsch say in their comment on Genesis and the wind of this verse. They say, literally the wind of the day, i.e. towards evening, when the cooling wind begins to blow. And what Kyle and Delitzsch are referring to is that in the Middle East and in Israel, precisely according to that map that we had drawn on the screen last night, at a certain time the wind comes in from the sea and blows across the land and cools it down from the heat of the day. So translating it the cool of the day was because that's what this wind did. It cooled the land as it came from the sea. And you never guess where that wind began to blow, would you? It began to blow in across the land at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at precisely the time the evening lamb was offered under the law of Moses. And what's interesting about this verse, brothers and sisters, is that in the record of Genesis, it doesn't use the normal word for evening, and I think deliberately so. So here it is. You see, the normal word for evening in the Hebrew is erev. But it's not erev here. The Vulgate translates the phrase the cool of the day as ad autem post meridian, which actually means towards the gold of the day with reference to the afternoon sun. It has already fallen from its zenith. It's at the 3 o'clock time as it begins its fall, the gold of the afternoon sun. And the Septuagint doesn't use the phrase with the normal Greek word for evening either, which is espera. So the Septuagint uses a special word to capture this idea of the cool of the day. And the word it uses is the word dilanos, which it translates, incidentally, as afternoon and not evening. They heard the voice of Yahweh Elohim walking in the garden in the afternoon, is how the Septuagint translates that phrase, the cool of the day. But let me tell you something interesting about that word dilanos. That word dilanos is never, ever found in the New Testament, even though it's a Greek word. It's never used in the New Testament. It's only ever found as a Greek word in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And outside of this one passage, and I think this passage is the same anyway, in every other place that it's used in the Old Testament, it always refers to the time of the offering of the evening lamb. It's used in Exodus 29, verses 39 and 41, in Leviticus 6, verse 20, in the 1st of Kings 18, verse 29, and in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 31, and verse 3. And this is the word that's hidden here in Genesis chapter 3 to tell us that this is the moment when this transaction occurred. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when the evening lamb was offered, was when this episode occurred. And so the record tells us of the time that the lamb of Genesis chapter 3 was slain. And in the telling of it, I think we've got Gabriel's signature in the record to say that he was there. So let me explain to you now what the signature of Gabriel, I think, is. The signature of Gabriel is a signature of time. Who set the moment for this encounter in the paradise of God? And the answer is the angel did. The angel could have chosen any moment to appear in the garden, to talk to Adam and Eve and to offer this lamb. He chose this moment of encounter. In fact, he had probably arranged that by having previous conversations with them in the garden at the same time in the afternoon. But by setting that moment, what Gabriel did is he fixed the time for the offering of the first evening lamb that the Bible will ever record. And from henceforth, the evening lamb will always be offered at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And at critical moments in the unfolding of Messiah's work, Gabriel will appear either at the time the evening lamb is being offered or while the evening lamb is burning upon the altar. And that will be his signature. And here's the first of them, right here, I think, in Genesis chapter 3. It's the signature of Gabriel, you see. This moment when it says, they heard the voice of Yahweh Elohim walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And so in the Garden of Eden, the first lamb was offered under the watchful eye of the superintending angel who instructed Adam concerning the sacrifice. And that event occurred at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the appointed time for the evening lamb. And I suggest that this indeed is the signature of Gabriel to witness that he was present in the garden with Adam on this occasion. From now on, brothers and sisters, in all of our studies, we will discover that signature. And so this study then is really the story of God's plan of redemption, the unique work of atonement that would be accomplished in the sacrifice of Christ. It's the story of sin and its resolution. A crisis introduced in Eden by the first sin of Adam and Eve, and a crisis that won't be resolved until the end of the millennium. Our journey has begun today in Genesis. It won't end until we get to the book of Revelation, like all good Bible stories do. And it will trace the story of a special angel and a special lamb. So special, both of them, that they will be bound together in the record from henceforth. So what do you think Gabriel learned out of this episode in terms of his own experience? Because I think Gabriel was going to learn things on this journey, you see. Well, here's what Gabriel learned. You see, what Gabriel observed firsthand was the sorrow and the shame that would be caused by transgression. He would understand how sin brought a rupture of fellowship because he who had conversed with them in the garden found that these now hid themselves from him. There was a rupture, and Gabriel himself felt that. And it was Gabriel who later in this chapter would drive them forth from the garden so that they did not have access to the tree of life. And he would have known of his own impotence to restore them back to that state of paradise, that only the coming of the Lord whom he served could open that way anew. And he didn't just witness that. He witnessed their horror in seeing the lamb slain and its blood shed their realization of guilt, their desire for covering, their wonder at God's provision, their thankfulness for God's salvation. And Gabriel suddenly understood the power of emotion that will be involved in this atoning work that he was so privileged to prepare for our Lord Jesus Christ, who is a long way yet far off before he shall be made manifest. But already his angel was at work in the affairs of mankind under the providence of Almighty God himself. And I think finally Gabriel understood that this work of redemption was going to be terribly real. It was going to be intensely personal. He learned the power of what Christ's work would accomplish and just what salvation through the evening lamb would mean. It was good that Gabriel would learn those things. It's the same with all of us, brothers and sisters, as that which at first we understand intellectually. It's not until we understand it experientially that we know its real power. And for Gabriel to be ready for the work of Christ when Christ came, he needed to be taken on his own journey of understanding by the Father that he might be truly prepared for the work of his Son. And what might we learn from this opening episode in Genesis chapter 3? I think the first thing that we understand is that God alone has provided the means of redemption that is consistent with his requirements. Yahweh Elohim made the coat. God did it. He alone has the right to set the terms of reconciliation for the rupture of fellowship caused by sin. Our part is not to debate God's modus operandi. Our part is to have that attitude of honest integrity that bows before God and recognizes our desperate need. Our part is to have that spirit of humility that submits to God's appointed means as the only basis for salvation from sin. Our part is to show that meekness of heart that is the condition that enables us to recognize God as the supreme power, whose sole prerogative it is to provide a resolution to the problem of sin that is consistent with his own holiness and fulfills his own objectives. Do you know what Adam and Eve really learnt, brothers and sisters? They learnt what we must all learn, is that God is able to do what we cannot. That's where atonement begins. Acknowledging that we have a problem, understanding that we cannot solve it, but believing that God can, is where proper understanding of the atonement begins. So right here, in the sanctuary of Eden, at the place of paradise, we see Gabriel for the first time. We will not see him again for 2,000 years. But when we do, his coming will be unmistakable and his intervention will be dramatic indeed. And when that was, and why he came, is God willing, our next study.